Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. There are billions of people across the world living in poverty. And it's not uncommon for girls in developing countries to be married off or working by the time they reach the fifth grade. But
you know, the reality is if you keep a girl in school for the every year that she remains in school between 6th and 12th grade, her earning potential goes up by 15% on average every year.
Meet the new social entrepreneurs, Lila Jana of Sama Group and Erin Ganju of Room to Read. Breaking the cycle of poverty for millions of women. That's our inflection point. $800 million people around the world are illiterate. Two-thirds of them are women and girls. Room to Read is an organization that believes that world change starts with educated children. Our guest, Erin Ganju, is the co-founder and CEO of Room to Read. Erin Ganju, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lauren.
We talk a lot in the United States about women in leadership, leaning in, more female CEOs. But your organization, Room to Read, is starting with the most fundamental of skills for girls in the developing countries where you have teams. Tell us about the primary programs that Room to Read offers and where you are finding the most need.
Well, we at Room to Read believe that education is a critical tool to solving so many of the world's problems. And we're all about creating great transformational change in schools in low-income countries. And our two core areas that we focus on are our early grade literacy and a girls' education program. And this is really because, you know, at the end of the day, there are almost 800 million people that are still illiterate on this planet. Two-thirds of them are women and girls. And so we fundamentally have to deal with these issues in order to really create an equal opportunity for everybody.
So what are the countries where you are based?
We're our operational work is in 10 countries between Asia and Africa, 7 in Asia and 3 in Africa. But we actually raise awareness and funds and, you know, build a global movement, if you will, around supporting Room to Read across Europe, you know, Australia, Asia, and, you know, reach many places with the message from Room to Read.
So the two programs that you are primarily focused on, there's education for boys and girls, right? Literacy and access to libraries. And then you've got the girls' education program. Can you just elaborate a little bit on each of those?
Sure. I mean, the reality is, as a world, we've really done a much better job of getting children into school. So it's sometimes just important to celebrate and focus on the fact that organizing ourselves around the Millennium Development Goals and Education for All has driven down the number of children that are out of school. But the other sad news is that, unfortunately, the quality in many of our schools around the world is so low, children aren't learning. So there's more than 250 million children, mostly in low-income countries, that is 40% of the primary age-going population, that show up in a classroom and cannot read, write, or do basic numeracy. By, fourth grade, fifth grade, they drop out because they are still functionally illiterate and they can't, you know, really make use of remaining in a classroom. So that's, the issue we're trying to address. And so our literacy program focuses on how can we create that deep systemic transformational change in a school, at the primary school. And we do that through a combination of a few great tools. One is, really focusing on creating a print-rich environment around literacy. You know, we've all probably know what a school library looked like in our, education. And we want every child to have that no matter where they're born. And so we print local language books. We create these great libraries that are really child-friendly. And then we really work with teachers to also address the issues in grade one and grade two to have more solid instruction, literacy instruction. And by working with teachers, boosting their schools, creating new materials for the classrooms, we're able to both address improving the skills as well as the habit of reading. And that's how our literacy program works.
So, and then what about the girls' education program?
So with the girls' education program, the issue is really that the transition from primary school to secondary school, many girls drop out. And so what we're really addressing is how to keep these girls in school more holistically. One is, in many cases, there are sometimes material sort of scholarship, fees that prevent poor families from sending all their children to school. And so they select their elder male children. And so we address that. But actually what we're seeing more and more is that by working with all the girls in a grade, a lot of it is just around societal real biases, too, around educating girls. And so we have a life skills program delivered by social mobilizers in our language, which are female role models and mentors that are from the local communities, you know, trained by Room to Read, the Room to Read staff. And they work with the girls outside of the formal school day, doing extracurricular life skills workshops. And this combination of keeping girls in school longer, as well as having this life skills workshop that empower them to be able to make more choices and have more awareness of their opportunities, is a really great combination.
So there's a great story on the Room to Read blog about a female student in Laos who not only found her own voice through your life skills class, but she's now advocating for you, mm-hmm. bringing more girls into the program. So what's another example of a girl who's benefited from one of these programs in life skills?
Well, the last time I was in Cambodia a few months ago, I met what was actually sort of the embodiment of Room to Read, I think, in one person, which is really amazing. So Room to Read is having our 15th anniversary this year. We're impacted over 10 million children so far. And when I was in Cambodia, I met Sin, and she's a lovely young woman who has just started teaching at her primary school in her rural community in Cambodia. But she was actually on our girls' education program for about 6 years. And so she was a very unique woman. She's the only person in her family who's ever made it to the end of secondary school, end of 12th grade. She then went on to teacher training college, graduated from that. She had a scholarship from the government of Cambodia, and she was placed back in her rural community school. And the great news was that at that school then had a Room to Read library. And she went through our literacy training program because she's a grade one teacher. And so she's almost had every element of Room to Read's work right. embodied in her. And we had this really special moment because I just told her, you know, thank you so much. Like, it's so wonderful to hear how our work has, you know, impacted you and improved your life and your opportunities. And she was such a confident woman. You know, this is all being translated, of course, between the two of us. And she said, how can you thank me? You know, I have to thank you. Like, I have a totally different life opportunity. And I said, no, you know, it's not because of Room to Read. It's because of all your perseverance, your hard work. You know, you've gone after every one of your goals and succeeded. And that's what makes us, you know, so excited to be a part of our lives. So it really was kind of a full circle moment, if you will, for us. It was really wonderful.
Well, and you founded Room to Read in what year?
In 2000, there are three of us that founded Room to Read, and it's actually a neat kind of combination of skills. So John Wood had come out of Microsoft, and he was traveling in the late 90s in Nepal, and he had a great love for Nepal, and he went into a school, and the headmaster said, you know, please send us some books. We really want some books for our library. And so John, being a total go-getter, ended up, you know, collecting books, English books from home, and sending them. But he needed somebody to connect with in Nepal to help deliver these books back to this rural village. And so his father wrote to the Lions Club, and he met Dinesh Shestra, who's our other co-founder, who'd been working on a, you know, polio eradication scheme in the area that John had been trekking in. And so the two of them got connected, and this started Books for Nepal, which was really a, you know, book donation program at the beginning. I met them a little while later and had been working in Vietnam, which is a country I actually lived in for 3 years in the 90s on some education projects. And we kind of combined forces and started to think about a scalable, replicable model across countries. What would you do to address the issue of the fact that poor rural schools and many low-income countries just don't have the resources that they need? And that's how kind of the birth of Room to Read. We focused then on saying we want to go to many countries, not just one or two, not just Nepal and Vietnam, but, you know, being able to go to a lot more with this model.
So how do you work with the local schools? You've got the local nationals, and you've got the schools, and you're talking about that they're not necessarily set up for success and kids were not learning. So how do you get in there without, you know, making someone feel defensive or, you know, get out of my school?
So we're working all through the government public schools. And I think that's a really important piece of our model that helps us be sustainable, because we are working in a system that, you know, exists, that if you can be a social catalyst for change, bring new resources, new pedagogy, you know, ideas and ways of innovation and approaching education, you know, it is a very scalable system. Now, obviously, governments are not necessarily known for their cutting edge innovation, but we do find that in the countries that we work in, there's a lot of receptivity to wanting to, you know, learn from us. And we're bringing international best practices, but we're combining it with, you know, deep local knowledge of our staff from the education system. And so the schools want you to build a level of trust and communication. You know, we say, look, we're not trying to judge you whether you're doing a good job or a bad job. We're just trying to help you do your job, make it easier, give you new ideas and new resources. And if you approach it from that relationship building, you know, standpoint and build that trust, we found them very receptive to working with us.
So you mentioned social mobilizers. Can you tell us what they do and how you hire them?
Yes, certainly. I mean, they are in many ways, I think, powerful examples of what, you know, we all know to be true, which is that if you have a mentor, you know, a role model in your life, you know, you can go a lot further, right? It takes a village to raise a child. And so these women are from the communities that we are working in. They are often living, you know, in the same communities that the girls are. They understand that community's social norms. Many of the families are their neighbors or friends. They speak the language, obviously. And so what we're doing is really building their skills to help ensure that they're able to interact with the girls, the families, the school environment, to advocate on behalf of the girls, ensure that they're getting, you know, all the attention that they need, encouragement to stay in school, and actually working mostly with the girls themselves. It's not very common in many of the communities that we're working in for groups of women and girls to come together. That's actually, you know, somewhat of that, you know, often women are kept in their, you know, home or encouraged to stay at home, do what they do a lot of enormous amount of work, as we all know. I mean, there is, I think if there's any secret in, you know, the developing world, it's the fact that women do almost everything, whether it's agricultural work or it's the home, you know, life requirements, you know, raising the family, et cetera. And so really bringing them into other places and talking about this and talking about, you know, what are the challenges as they face and giving them a chance to come together and set their own goals is a very powerful part of our model.
You talked about when a girl gets to fifth grade, she's much more likely to drop out of school. You talked about it being a financial thing, a cultural thing. What are some of the other reasons for that? Is it about being part of, you know, it's basically the home workforce? I mean, what's driving that?
And there is, you know, definitely differences by country, I should say, too. I think, you know, one of the challenges is given the 10 countries we work in, and of course, you know, the broader low-income countries across Asia and Africa, there's numerous cultural, you know, country challenges that I don't want to minimize. But, and, you know, generally you see some patterns. And some of those patterns are the fact that, one, in terms of economics, most of the families we're working on with are living on a dollar or two or less a day. And they may have, you know, 3, 4, 6, 7 kids. They're probably, parents are probably illiterate and daily wage earners, meaning they don't have a, you know, a income, a regular income. And so they're challenged by many, you know, very difficult situations. And so what happens is they often are not really placing, because of their challenges to survive, not really placing a priority on education. So a lot of what we're doing is really working, you know, with these families to encourage them not just to send a couple of children, but to send all their children to school, and particularly focusing on their girls. And really saying, you know, don't keep a girl at home because she has to do the extra chores, that she, you know, may not be valued as, you know, she's going to get off and go be married and married off to another family. She may not be seen as valuable as the eldest male children, and really to try to change some of those beliefs. You know, the reality is if you keep a girl in school for the every year that she remains in school, between 6th and 12th grade, her earning potential goes up by 15% on average every year. So she's gets to the end of 12th grade, she can change, you know, the income and the quality of life for and generations to come for her family. And so there are really important reasons that, you know, it's important to ensure that she is supported and that she has an opportunity to really help the family and break that cycle of poverty.
And I read a statistic from the USAID that girls with secondary schooling are up to 6 times less likely to marry as children compared to girls who have little or no education. So in a developing country, what are some of the other reasons that will motivate a family to let their girl stay in school? You mentioned the income increase year over year, 15%. Yeah. They're going to marry not as young. Is there anything else that might be communicated to a family that would interest them?
Yeah, and I would actually, I should also mention, there's a great film called Girl Rising. Actually, Suma, who is one of the Kamilaroi girls that was rescued and put back into school on Room to Read's program, is featured in that film, is one of the chapters. And it features the stories of 9 girls across 9 different countries. And it's all about the power of investing in adolescent education for girls. So with this film, you'll see a lot of the, you know, the different kinds of challenges similar to what we're talking about. But I think, you know, the main ones, of course, are that, you know, there is early marriage. There are economic reasons girls, you know, stay at home. I think the other ones are, you know, oftentimes that they're, you know, the high school environment isn't necessarily very child friendly or girl friendly. There often are not latrines for boys and girls that are separated. So many girls talk about once they start to menstruate, not wanting to go to school during that time period because there's no privacy for them. And then if they miss a certain number of school days, they start to fall behind quite regularly, and it becomes more and more challenging to stay, to keep up and to stay in school. So it's a complex issue. I mean, there are numerous reasons why girls drop out. But at the end of the day, what we have seen is it's a badge of honor. Exactly as you're saying, you know, when a girl is in a uniform, there's a certain amount of respect and protection that she receives in the community. And we hear that from girls, you know, all the time, that they really do feel a sense of pride when they have their school uniform on. And I think people look at them differently, treat them differently when they know they're being educated. And so that is a key way to help protect girls and really let them grow up and be girls for longer.
We're talking to Erin Ganju, co-founder and CEO of Room to Read. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Lauren Schiller. If you're enjoying Inflection Point, help us make more episodes. You can donate to the show on inflectionpointradio.org. Just go to the website and look for the donate button. It's super simple, and we will really appreciate it. Thank you. You're listening to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guest is Erin Ganju, co-founder and CEO of Room to Read. So your organization, Room to Read, is getting a lot of attention, in particular coming up at the time of this recording, a visit from First Lady Michelle Obama to Cambodia. She's going to meet up with Cambodia's First Lady, Mrs. Bun Rani.
Yes.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, exactly.
I hope so. Okay,
yeah.
Super. Bun Rani. And they're going to meet with high school students that are enrolled in Room to Read Girls Education. How did that come together?
So as people might have heard, First Lady Mrs. Obama really was going out recently and promoting, encouraging more girls to stay in school. It's called the Let Girls Learn Initiative. And it's a global initiative to focus on the power of investing in girls' education. And she wanted to have the opportunity to sit down with some of the girls globally that are challenged to stay in school. And so we're very honored. It's actually the first time that a current First Lady has visited Cambodia. So we're very honored that First Lady Obama and First Lady Rani will be in one of our schools in Cambodia. We'll be sitting down with 10 of our girls on the Girls' Education program and really just be, learning about their life stories, learning about the challenges they have in staying in school, learning about the efforts of Room to Read to support them and what impact that is having on themselves and their families, to create a community conversation around this issue of the challenges of girls remaining in school. So we're quite honored by the visit, and I think it's a great way to really raise awareness globally for how important this is.
So let's talk about tracking success. You have a wonderful report that you put out every few years or so. I just was looking through one. And I'm wondering, what are some of the results that you're most excited about with Room to Read?
Yeah, actually, we, on an annual basis, publish our global monitoring report. And it's one of the ways we try to keep our investors, our partners, our government partners, our other NGO partners, really engaged in our work. And so we look at about 30 different indicators on, and we measure them at different levels of frequency throughout the year. But they are basically kind of the guideposts of how our programs are doing. And we want to be very transparent and share this information with all those who care about this, global movement to focus on education. So some of the key indicators we look at, if we take the girls' education program, oftentimes we're looking at how many girls in the program are staying in school and advancing to the next grade as like key indicators. So we know that 94% of our girls last year either remained in the program or graduated out of the program, which is a very high number compared to the, very at-risk situations that they're in. We also know that 96% of them advanced to the next grade, did well enough in school, to go to the next grade. We know now that out of the graduates from 12th grade, 72% of them have gone on to tertiary education, university education. And this is not through funding from Room to Read. So our formal program ends at 12th grade, but they're getting other scholarships through the government and other organizations, and they're going on and being able to, for the first time, certainly in their families, being able to make it to university. And so when you think about how game-changing this is for their lives, most of their mothers and fathers, they tell us, never finished high school. Their mothers oftentimes never finished third or fourth grade. And for them to be a university, graduate is a huge change.
That's really incredible. I mean, congratulations.
It's great, great to be able to have that data.
So at this point, Erin, you've reached nearly 10 million children with your work. But obviously, you didn't start off with 10 million children to help. So how did this all get started for you?
Well, for me, it definitely was a bit of a windy road and a journey that, you know, I always love those stories when there's one aha moment. But for me, there are several aha moments over time. I mean, I did start out actually as an investment banker. I worked out of New York and then Singapore. And that was a great training ground to give me a lot of experience just on you know, finance, on what it takes to make a successful company work, and, you know, many really rooted, grounded experience in business. Then I really decided, you know, I wanted to make sure that I lived somewhere when I was younger, in my 20s, that really challenged me to think about the world differently. And so I actually decided, I left Goldman Sachs in Singapore and moved to Vietnam in the mid-90s. A little bit of a crazy thing to do. It just actually opened up to foreign direct investment. And so we were some of the first foreigners living in Ho Chi Minh City. And I worked for Unilever. We were trying to get their license for many of their products. And it was a wonderful experience. I spent 3 years. And by the time I left, after a few founding group of 10 people, we had employed over 2,500 Vietnamese people. We had set up three different businesses for them, and ice cream and, you know, different food products that Unilever has. And it was an amazing experience to see, you know, we were hiring people for state-of-the-art factories with equipment out of Europe that had no electricity in their homes, had never used a phone, never seen a computer. And what it taught me was, you know, education is central to being able to break that cycle of poverty, because we were looking for a population that didn't exist. You know, we were looking for a rural population that had a certain basic level of education to be able to work in at Unilever. And so what we started doing is a lot of community outreach. We actually started going out and saying, you know, we need to help improve the schools, and we need to help improve, you know, public health and all these issues so that we could create communities that we could really, you know, continue to work in. And that then soon became my real love and passion, because as we started getting involved in a lot of the development efforts, I realized this is what I really wanted to do with my life. And that's, you know, sort of how some of those aha moments occurred for me.
So once you got started in the field, how did you know that this would work as an organization in and of itself?
Well, as I mentioned, with my co-founders, Dinesh and John, who had been working in Nepal, and myself in Vietnam, you know, we started to really hit on some themes, I think, early on that we could see were working. I mean, one, I think, is we started to understand that the government systems were critical to invest in, because that was a system. We weren't trying to replicate a separate system to educate children. We were trying to really improve and invest in the current system. And you can be a real catalyst for change within the government system. And that was, you know, I think, central to our model. And we also really realized that having it be very contextualized within each of the countries was critical. So there are certainly international best practices and a lot that we draw on around key things we know of how education works, but that only works if it's working in each community, right? So we really have to focus on how do you engage, you know, parents in the community and teachers in the school administration and working with us to contextualize the program. And I think those are some of the core themes. I'd also say, actually, that, you know, the way that we have created a global movement to fundraise and raise awareness for Room to Read was really unique too. We actually started to establish a chapter model very early on that now operates with over 15,000 volunteers in 43 different cities around the world and 13 different countries. And they are a core part of how we raise our annual operating budget. They, you know, throw events, invite friends, build awareness in the community, you know, are our outreach and our feet on the street. We actually raise 51% of our money outside of the United States. So as a small, you know, American charity originally, it's pretty phenomenal that we now have such a global footprint of on our fundraising.
So how did these people come to be part of your organization, these chapters?
Well, first was a lot of our friends. We had worked, you know, for in global corporations and, you know, kind of reached out and pressured all our friends to say, hey, you can be the chapter leader for Chicago and throw a great event, or for New York or London. But then it really built on itself. I mean, a lot of it is, I think, you know, there's a real thirst in the world to create change. You know, people want to be part of a movement that uses their time and their talent and, you know, to ways that they can really be productive. And so we weren't asking people to, you know, stuff envelopes or, you know, do something. We were saying, hey, come in and, you know, use your PR skills or use your, you know, sales skills or use your financial skills. Help us, you know, make each of these cities really a great, you know, network in and of itself, reaching out and building on the talent that volunteers could bring to it. And so it's a really little bit of a kind of decentralized model, right, where we ask for them to, you know, think of different ideas and create different models at work. And there's been some crazy ones. I mean, we had our chapter out of Tokyo came up with beers for books, right? You know, and where they, you know, wanted to go out out and be able to drink beer in a pub, and a certain portion of every beer went to room to read. We've had, you know, Namaste Yoga days that have gone global. We've had, you know, all sorts of campaigns, if you will, you know, Girls Night Out, Girls Night In, different things that the chapters have come up with to really make fundraising fun again, you know, to make it a great way to build awareness and raise needed resources for our mission.
So how can more people get involved?
Absolutely.
How do you sign up to have a chapter?
All you have to do is go to our website and really, you know, I think it's all about bringing your ideas and creativity. We have some chapters that exist, and you can definitely funnel right into one of those 43 cities that already have an active chapter. They're great internationally minded people that are total go-getters. And you can start your own. And there's a lot of the information on our website of how to do that. But we really, you know, welcome people joining the movement.
Well, congratulations on everything that you've done and everything that you've built to date. I'm sure that it's going to be, you know, double, triple the next time we sit down and talk, right?
I hope so. The reality is, and on a, you know, somewhat of a sad note, the reality is there's so much need out there. I mean, it is, in my mind, you know, a crime against humanity that there are still 791 million people illiterate when we know exactly how to teach people to read and write. And so this is a problem that we can actually solve in our own lifetime. We can absolutely end illiteracy if we are committed, if we have the political will, the social will, if we dedicate the time, the resources to solving this issue. So I hope that we don't lose another generation. I hope that every child can grow up with a quality school in their community that allows them to grow up fully empowered and you know, turn their dreams into a reality. That's what we need to change the world.
Well, bringing us back to you, Erin, what are you reading right now?
Well, I actually just the other night finished Wild by Cheryl Strayed. I love stories of powerful women, as you might imagine. It's one of my favorite topics to read on, and so I love stories of how people came against odds and grew personally and professionally, you know, beyond their wildest dreams. And so I'm always looking for great books. I actually also grew up in Eugene, Oregon, and so had known many people have hiked the Pacific Crest Trail. So it was a great book.
Is that something you might want to do? Hike the Pacific Crest
Trail? I'm not sure I could do it. I mean, particularly after reading, if you've ever read Wild.
Yes, I've read it.
I'm not sure that I could do it for as long. I could probably last a few days. I do love to hike, but I'm more of a 2 or 3 days rather than 2 or 3 months hiker.
Fair enough. Well, Erin Ganju, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Lauren.
This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. Hi, I'm Lauren Schiller. If you're liking what you hear, help us make more episodes. You can find our teeny tiny little donate button at inflectionpointradio.org. Just scroll down to the bottom of the page, click the donate button, and fill out the simple form. If you've got bigger aspirations and would like to underwrite our show, we would love to talk to you. In that case, you can just email me directly at lauren@inflectionpointradio.org. Thank you. I'm Lauren Schiller, and you're listening to Inflection Point. There are billions of people across the world who are living in poverty. Our next guest, Lila Jana, is the founder and CEO of an organization that not only provides for the social good, but actually benefits the private sector as well. Lila Jana, welcome to Inflection Point.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So your nonprofit organization, Sama Group, which you established in 2008, has 3 social ventures under the Sama brand. Tell us a bit about each and what connects all 3 of them.
Sure. So we started in 2008 with Sama Source, which connects very low-income people living in East Africa, South Asia, and Haiti to work through the internet. We pioneered a model that is now at the vanguard of a new movement called impact sourcing, which involves taking big technology projects and breaking them down into smaller tasks and teaching very low-income people how to do these tasks. And that model of impact sourcing, which is now this broader movement that aims to use sourcing practices in the business world to dramatically impact poverty, that model has been scaling around the world sort of beyond Sama Source now. We have impacted 6,700 workers directly. On average, they triple their incomes after joining SamaSource. And after about 9 months, they attrit to higher paying work or higher education. And 89% of the workers that have gone through our system have moved on to a positive employment or educational outcome. So far, that model is working pretty well. At Sama USA, which is our second social venture, which we founded based on the learnings that we'd had from SamaSource in the Bayview District here in San Francisco, we have a model that trains low-income people to harness technology skills to succeed in the new economy. So the workforce is dramatically changing. The jobs that are available to lower-income Americans are dramatically changing. We're seeing a huge shift towards freelancing and towards a portfolio approach to income. So in the past, where we would train people to do a 9-to-5 retail or hospitality-type job, we can now train them to have the skills to find their own work on platforms like TaskRabbit, Care.com, Odesk, and Elance, and there's a whole range of these. I won't comment on what that means for the average American worker. I think that's a separate issue. But our job is to prepare people to be resilient to these economic shifts and to not be caught off guard when they happen. And so that model, which has been in pilot phase for the last year and a half, also has seen some pretty dramatic success. It costs us about a third the cost of the lowest priced alternative in workforce development. And on average, our workers are able to supplement their incomes by about $1,200 in the 6 months following our program, which is a really sort of efficient 8-week boot camp in digital work skills.
All right. And then the third one?
The third venture is Sama Hope. And Sama Hope is a little bit different. It's a crowdfunding platform for medical treatments. And we started it as an experiment in 2011. I had the idea after visiting Sierra Leone on SamaSource business and meeting a doctor who was performing critical maternal care and desperately needed more funds. And I really wasn't planning to start another social venture. I had my hands full with SamaSource and with the expansion ideas that led to Sama USA. But I stumbled into a developer who made a quick website for me, and we sort of started it as a little experiment that was a fun side project and didn't really pay much attention to it beyond telling this doctor's story. And it started getting attention. Fast Company profiled it. We started getting some more media. We were on a major Canadian TV station. And people started sending in all sorts of input and saying that this platform was sorely needed. At the time, there was no crowdfunding site for medical treatments. And we focus on maternal and child health, which is a dramatically underfunded category in global health. Sama Hope is now kind of looking at more of a partnership model with big corporations. What we've found the most success around is getting big companies to underwrite the cost of delivering surgeries and medical care, and then some of our donors to fund our very lean operating costs. And so that's the Sama Hope model now. And we've funded 1,300 critical patient treatments that have extended the life years of the beneficiaries by 50 years. So we have a number of treatments that have impacted people who are quite young, so mothers who were teen mothers when they gave birth and suffered from conditions like fistula and other maternal health issues. And so for those people, they essentially get their lives back once they receive a critical treatment. So though the numbers seem lower, the depth of the impact is quite significant.
And how would you characterize the connective tissue between all three of these?
Well, Sama means equal in Sanskrit. And when I founded SamaSource, I was really passionate about leveling the playing field for opportunity and using new technology and methods from the private sector to do that. There are very few organizations in the nonprofit sector that have this R&D kind of approach and that use technology and private sector methods, and I thought we could add a lot to the solution set if we piloted some of these ideas. And at the beginning, when we started SamaSource, you know, I had no idea if it would actually work out. I think part of what we're trying to add to the discussion at Sama Group is less of a fear of failure in the nonprofit world and comfort with testing out new things in a disciplined way, but just to see if they might work, because we are facing some pretty enormous challenges in the social impact sector. And if we don't start trying new things, I fear that we're going to leave a lot of opportunities on the table.
And could you articulate some of the challenges that you're referring to?
Sure. Well, if you just take the issue that Sama Hope works on, maternal and child health, every 90 seconds a woman dies in childbirth. We lose 300,000 women annually in childbirth and the period around childbirth, and 99% of those deaths are preventable, according to the World Health Organization. Paul Farmer, who is a very well-respected doctor who works in global health, has said that surgery is the neglected stepchild of global health. It does not get enough funding. And the reason that medical treatment gets less funding is that if you look at the return on investment from a very, you know, rational economic lens, the cost per life year that you save is very high compared to interventions like prevention or vaccinations or deworming or any of the number of things that are done in global health. So as a result, some of the biggest foundations that are working on this don't have the focus on funding treatment. And because of that, we thought, well, why not try something that could get public funds from individuals like you and me who, you know, have heartstrings that can get pulled by these stories? Why not see if that, you know, if that might work to raise money for this really important issue? And that's just one example. At Sama Source, we work on the issue of access to employment. And we work in communities where unemployment rates, for example, you know, youth in Kenya and certain communities face unemployment rates of 70 or 80%. If you can get a job at all, it's in the informal economy. I was in Kenya last year in the fall and met with one of our workers who, prior to Sama Source, was earning money by brewing a local type of moonshine called Chang'a in Mathare slum, which is extremely potent, which is often mixed with kerosene to make it more addictive. And causes blindness and severe addiction. And this is a young man who went to one of Nairobi's best boarding schools on scholarship, and then, like so many young people in his country, couldn't find any work after that, and so was forced to do this just to make a living and to be able to support his wife and his daughter. And that's the reality for so many people who are seeking work, even people who are motivated, who are educated, and who, you know, who really have a raw skill set. So those are some of the, just a few of the challenges.
So in developing countries that have these terrible unemployment rates, who are you bringing in to work for Sama Source?
So we think of digital work as a hammer that can hit many nails. It's a broad solution that can be applied to many different constituencies. And in the beginning, you know, focus is really important to prove out a model. So we decided to start by hiring slum youth and women in Nairobi, in Kenya, for various reasons. Nairobi was about to get fiber optic internet capacity for the first time. A lot of funders, like the World Bank, were really interested in investing in the digital economy in Kenya. And we had a couple of funders who were willing to give us the financial backing to try this out. And in parallel, Kenya, like Nigeria and Ghana and several other former British colonies in sub-Saharan Africa, has a large population of educated youth who have extremely high unemployment rates. And that problem has been shown to drive terrorism, to drive a number of other outcomes that are really bad for Kenya and for the world as a whole. So we thought that would be a really great place to start our model. The slums are pretty proximate to the centers where people can do this work. And so we identified a bunch of people who ran internet cafes and who ran computer labs. And we thought, let's use these people as local partners and get them to hire youth and women from the slums to do this work. So youth is pretty broadly defined. It's 18 to 30. On average, I think the average age of our workers is about 22, 23. But many of them come in with children or other income dependents, including parents and siblings, younger siblings in the family.
We're talking to Lila Jana, founder and CEO of Sama Group. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point. We'll be back right after this. Hi, I'm Lauren Schiller. If you're enjoying Inflection Point, help us make more episodes. You can donate to the show on inflectionpointradio.org. Just go to the website and look for the donate button. It's super simple, and we will really appreciate it. Thank you. You're listening to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guest is Lila Jana, founder and CEO of Sama Group. Who are some of the clients that you're serving, and what is some of the work that your people are doing?
Sure. So when we started, the thesis was, you know, let's train these people to do simple computer-based tasks that don't make economic sense to do in the U.S. and that are being done by bigger outsourcing companies in places like India and the Philippines that are for-profit. And let's see if we can get companies to buy into our model of social impact and to support us, because we can do really good quality work, first and foremost, and then secondly, because there's a high social impact to what we do. So it's it sort of strengthens the case of outsourcing internally when it's not just about making some company a lot more money.
Right. So. I know that. I mean, that is the question, is there's all this controversy around outsourcing and sending jobs overseas. And, mm-hmm. and you know, you can pay so much less in other countries than you can in the U.S.
It's a very real issue. And I should note that I got started in social justice work in high school, actually working for the ACLU in Southern California on a case that was related to educational equity in California, in Inglewood High School. So my start in all of these issues was actually domestic. Though my parents are from India, I was really passionate about domestic social justice issues. So it's kind of ironic that my first foray into this field professionally was abroad. As far as I'm concerned, a human being is a human being, wherever she happens to be born and reside, whether that's Bayview or, you know, Birmingham or Burkina Faso. And we have no less moral duty to someone who lives in Kenya, you know, or anywhere else than we do to someone who lives next door to us. And I think that, you know, that underlies our sort of core ethos at Sama Group. A human is a human, and all human beings deserve to have their inherent dignity recognized. So I started in Kenya opportunistically because the factors were right. I had a funder who was lined up, but longer term, I really saw the vision of expanding this model globally, including here in the U.S. And I think, you know, we don't even think about what we do as outsourcing. We think of it as impact sourcing. We think about helping a company design their sourcing strategy for maximal social impact. And doing that domestically and doing that abroad are not mutually exclusive. I think, you know, one of the challenges in the nonprofit sector is that there's historically been a big division between organizations that work, you know, NGOs, we call them, organizations that work abroad and they work on international poverty issues, and then domestic nonprofits, organizations that work here. And increasingly, the issues that we are tackling are cross-national. We're starting to see a big shift in the way income is distributed. The largest number of poor people don't live in the lowest income countries anymore. They live in two middle income countries. They live in China and India. So even thinking about the average income of the country you're working in as an indicator of the status of its citizenry is not helpful. So I think increasingly we need to go beyond, you know, the traditional lens of domestic versus international and be a little bit more agile than that. To get back to your question about the customers that we have
at Sama Source,
we started with, our first client was a local nonprofit called Benetech that had built a library for blind readers online called Bookshare.org. And they were digitizing books from PDF format into text format. And then once the files were in text format, they could be read through audio software for blind readers. And so we thought, what a cool first client. And also, they were the only company that would give me work because the founder is a social entrepreneur himself and I think empathized with my struggle. So they gave us a $30,000 contract in 2008. And at the time, when I say we, I'm really speaking about the royal we, because it was just me. I had someone who helped out before she went to business school, but I had no like full-time staff. So in the beginning, it was just me doing all of the quality assurance, reviewing the files, sending the files when I got them from the client to Kenya, and then getting them back, reviewing them, and sending them to the client. So that was our first client. And then pretty rapidly, I mean, I think that first year we did $30,000 in contracts. And we started in September of 2008. And then the following year, we went up to $200,000 plus in contracts. And we were just, I was giving talks all over the Bay Area, and I was getting everybody who had any work to do to sign up. Tim Ferriss, the author, would, you know, he gave us audio interviews to transcribe.
No wonder he has a four-hour work week.
Exactly. It really fit in with his thesis. He came out to Kenya with us and met some of the workers and was really moved. And then we started winning more business from bigger companies. So currently, our biggest customers are firms that include Microsoft, Google, Walmart.com, eBay, NVIDIA, Qualcomm, TripAdvisor, Getty Images, a number of really well-known companies. And it took us a while to build that book of business. Initially, our marketing, because I knew very little about corporate procurement practices, our marketing was really about the social impact. And pretty soon I learned that a procurement officer at Microsoft, as much as he might have, you know, a really big heart, needs to hit his numbers and needs to show his boss that he's making responsible business decisions. And so we really shifted our marketing several years ago to focus on the business value that we offer. And what I found is that the social impact is the icing on the cake. If we are competitive from a cost and quality standpoint, then I think it makes it really hard for a customer to shift vendors. So it's a great way to stay entrenched. And I think actually it's a very legitimate comparative advantage. And I think as we grow, we're going to start seeing that this is our, you know, one of the ways that we have staying power with our customers.
What are some examples of work that SamaSource employees do for any of these clients?
One of my favorite examples is the work that we do for Getty Images. Getty Images is one of the largest photo archives in the world, and they maintain a huge database of celebrity images. So if you can imagine, one of the projects that we have is currently staffed in northern Uganda in a post-conflict zone, which is very famous for Joseph Kony and child soldiers. And I'm sure people who are listening to this program know about the conflict in northern Uganda for the last, I think, 15 years. So the area has now stabilized in terms of the war, but is still in deep trouble because of lack of economic opportunity for all of the youth who still live there. So we hired about 120 of them. Through the project's history, we've employed nearly 400 young people in the town of Gulu at the local university. We built internet centers inside shipping containers that have solar panels on the top and that have high-speed internet access for the very first time. And inside those shipping containers, these young people are tagging images of celebrities, among other projects. So it's quite surreal to walk into one of these centers and to meet a smart Ugandan woman who comes from, you know, a farmer family in a rural town somewhere, who's sitting there in front of an image of Andy Murray or Rihanna. And this work might seem boring and meaningless to you or me, but for someone who comes from an extremely poor rural background, whose parents are subsistence farmers with very little to no education, this kind of work is a lifeline. And more than that, it's a stepping stone. So we find that workers, once they start learning that the internet is this tool that can provide economic opportunity, they start using it for other purposes. So we have workers who start watching Khan Academy videos. They figure out Coursera exists. They start teaching themselves things through the internet, which is a really new skill if you didn't grow up with the internet at home. And then many of them find better opportunities. So that's the intent. You know, we really see ourselves as a bridge employment provider. We want to get people from the informal economy and from the state of being unemployed and hopeless to a state where they are competitive in the new economy. And that's pretty much what we see with our workforce.
So what's the average length that someone will work for you?
About 9 months, and then they attrit to higher paying work or higher education, 89% of them.
And where are they getting the work?
Good question. So it's funny. Exactly. What we found is that in the bigger cities, so in Nairobi and Kampala, where we have a lot of our workforce, our biggest three hubs are Nairobi, Kampala, and an area outside of Calcutta in India. And in those areas, there is a formal employment sector. The challenge is that our workers, who are typically from slums and from lower income backgrounds, are not very visible to formal employers. They don't have CVs. They don't know how to present themselves. They don't know how to dress for an interview. They lack the soft skills to function in a professional environment. And so typically the people who get those you know, formal jobs are people who come from middle-income backgrounds, which is a small subset of people. So we find that workers in those areas are employable in the formal economy after SamaSource. They get jobs as bank tellers. They get jobs as administrative assistants in bigger companies. Many of them move up into the business process outsourcing industry and start doing quality assurance and other types of higher level work. And that's something that we love to see. We're probably one of the few employers that views attrition as a good thing.
Oh, I was going to say, you encourage turnover.
We do, as long as it's turnover to a better opportunity, because that frees up the seat that worker had for someone new who needs it. And we also get the benefit of having a big alumni network that comes out and supports us. Some of our workers go on to become trainers for us, so we actually promote them through our system. And the other thing that we've noticed is that many of our workers discover the online work opportunities beyond SamaSource through doing this work. We teach them about Odesk and Elance, which are two online employment platforms that have merged recently and now allow someone to compete for work from anywhere in the world for any customer in the world by posting a profile and submitting bids for projects. We have a number of workers who have found success on those platforms. One of them, a young woman who started with us doing data entry on a project very similar to the Bookshare project I mentioned, ended up leaving SamaSource work after about a year and a half and starting her own content writing agency from Nairobi. And the last time I spoke with her 2 years ago, she had 4 employees underneath her in her content writing agency, and she was writing content for websites all over the world. And this is someone who is just not exposed to that, you know, had no idea that this was a kind of work that you could even do.
Lila, is Sama Group self-funded then, if you've got contracts with these big technology companies?
Within SamaSource, we're almost break-even on the basis of earned revenue, which is quite rare in the nonprofit world. We've been around for 6 years. We've probably been less focused than we should have been on breaking even on the basis of earned revenue, but I wanted to do a bunch of R&D and sort of really prove out the model in different contexts. So by the end of this year, we will almost be at break-even. Right now, we're running at about 80% of our costs are covered through earned income, and that's just for the SamaSource business unit.
What did you bring with you today that inspires you?
So on a trip to India several years ago, I met this eccentric billionaire who recommended a book by a woman named Beryl Markham, who was one of the world's most prominent aviatrixes.
Okay.
Aviatrix is the technical term for a female aviator. And she pioneered aviation in East Africa in the 20s and 30s and then set a record, a world record, flying east to west across the Atlantic Ocean when she was 29. She grew up speaking Nandi, a local Kenyan language. She grew up in a rural area. Her father was, I think, a farmer or horse trader or something in the cowboy era of East Africa, and she grew up sort of running wild with the horses and speaking the native language and really knowing the land. And her book West with the Night is probably the best memoir I've ever read, and it details her experiences as a woman in this very male-dominated industry. As an adventurer, as a lover of Africa, and the open skies. And so it really moves me. So I'm actually rereading it now. I read it a couple of years ago, and her story is so inspiring that I decided I need a little bit more of it in my life.
Well, Lila Jana, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
That's our inflection point for today. We invite you to tell us your story, suggest a guest you'd like to hear from, and more at our website, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. Special thanks to Laura Scholes at Storyhouse Creative for giving me a room of my own on the web, Dana Smith at Dottoscope Communications for helping me spread the word, and to Paige Steinman at Veneer Studio for creative consultation.
I really love naming my animals after powerful female figures. And at the time, when I was like 8, the most powerful woman I could think of was Punky Brewster.
Thanks for listening. I'm Lauren Schiller.